Good morning and welcome. You are tuned into 2SER 107.3 and you're listening to Final Draft, 10 a.m. till 10:30 every Saturday on 2SER. You are in the realm of books, writing and literary culture. My name is Andrew Popel. I have the pleasure every week of bringing you new books from Australian authors from around the world. And today we're keeping it a little bit close to home. We're travelling just north and south from Sydney with two new novels that are intimately linked to the land. So we're going from Wollongong. In Wollongong, we've got Catherine McKinnon, or more correctly, the Illawarra. Her new novel, Storyland, is set in and around Lake Illawarra and taking us through generations from 1796 into our very near future and exploring the way we relate to the land and the stories that inhabit it. Later on in the show, I'm going to be speaking with Michael Sala. Michael Sala is based in Newcastle, and his novel, The Restorer, takes us back to Newcastle in 1989. It was a year where Newcastle was rocked by an earthquake, and world events gave us this really mixed feeling about where we were going. Michael Sala's story explores one family's relationship, and as it expands across that year. So as always, this is fantastic new Australian writing. I thoroughly enjoyed both these books. I loved getting ready, bringing you these interviews. So stay tuned. I'm going to take a short break and we're going to be back with books, writing, literary culture. We call it Final Draft. It's on 2SER 107.3.
To celebrate the success of 2SER's first ever podcast series, Just Words, we've teamed up with Audiocraft to bring you a live listening event on Thursday, May 18. Our podcast series has gone beyond the hype and headlines of Australia's racial discrimination laws, and you can watch the 2SER team record our final episode of Just Words live as we put 18C on trial and determine if our race hate laws really did murder free speech one last time. Come on down on Thursday, May 18, and listen to a mixture of live and recorded stories as we explore the new frontier of the culture wars. Doors open at 7 p.m. in Redfern at 107 Projects. Be sure to book your ticket now, as spaces are limited. To find out more, head to 2ser.com.
Good morning. You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Final Draft, and my name is Andrew Popel. I'm joined on the line right now by Catherine McKinnon. Her new novel, Storyland, takes us to the Illawarra and weaves a story throughout the generations, chronicling the land and the people who inhabit it. Welcome to Final Draft, Catherine.
Thank you.
Now, the byline for Storyland is, "The land is a book waiting to be read." It's both so very enigmatic, but tantalizingly close, I felt, to anyone who's close to the natural world, who loves just getting out and experiencing it. But I'm really curious, what did you mean by it?
That it comes from a line in the book that I've placed in the mouth of George Bass, a kind of fictional version of the historical George Bass, kind of talking about there's more for us to know about the land. That's what he starts with. But I think from my point of view, it comes from thinking about not only is there more for us to understand, but there is this kind of, there's been this argument in Australia. When I was young, I can remember people saying that the, you know, first Australians never farmed the land. And when I did a lot of the research in the early period around 1796, there were lots of quotes from people like Flinders or Payne, the boat builder, kind of grumbling about how the first Australians had not managed the land. And now there's this kind of new argument. People like Bill Gammage in The Biggest Estate on Earth are kind of saying, well, actually the land has always been managed. Obviously, Aboriginal people have always known this. It was a deep understanding of the relationship between soil and plants and animals.
Yeah, so if we follow the analogy further, essentially our pre-colonial or our understanding of the pre-colonial history of Australia, there's a certain illiteracy to it. We just really could not understand something that was maybe too sophisticated for us at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And even now, you know, with all the kind of writings about it, it's still something that we don't understand. It's a deep division. This European sense of ownership and possession, and contrasting to the kind of relationship to the land that the first Australians had.
So that idea of first contact and that the early colonial settlement brings me to what I was really curious about, because every story, of course, has to begin somewhere, and Storyland has many beginnings. You weave many tales into Storyland. And I was curious about why you chose Bass and Flinders, their journey on the Tom Thumb, as your opening narrative. Were you at all tempted to go further back into the history of the region?
I did. I did think about that and did a bit of research on that. And I suppose I was trying to think about what I could, felt I could as a writer, where I could start. And so, in a sense, I was also trying to understand, you know, thinking about my place in Australia and this idea that lots of Australians have many cultural backgrounds now. So I've got a kind of mixed cultural background, which could be Scottish, Irish, German, Danish, etc. So it's so mixed that really Australia is what I identify with, whereas I've got friends who are Irish and it's kind of they can trace the line back. So I was just trying to think of what happened when in those first contact periods from a perspective that I could write about. So for me, that was a kind of starting point. That's where I came to, where I could feel I could legitimately discuss what was going on.
Mm. So as Storyland progresses, you weave in narratives throughout the history and even the near future of the region, that sort of broader Illawarra region, and you mix your protagonists, and the story skirts genres. You've got sort of historical fiction, mystery and thriller. There's elements of YA and dystopian sci-fi. And when I say it like that, it feels like they shouldn't work, but they really work so well together. Was it fun melding these genres in together?
Yes, lots of fun. It's great. What links them all is the place. So there's all these different stories around one set of waterways and a river and a lake and the land around it. So that kind of binds everything together. It kind of gives it its grounding, if you like. And so, and in a way, it's different genres. But they've all got some things that link them in terms of that they've all got a kind of a level of violence involved with them, and they've all got a kind of puzzle that needs to be solved within them, and have a strong voice that is telling the story. So I suppose that there's all these linking things that were as well. But it was great fun to kind of work and think through. My favourite kind of genres, really, which are thrillers, which have puzzles and mysteries and things that kind of illuminate. You begin a story and you don't know where you are, and then by the end you're in a completely different place.
There are so many stories to talk about, and I'm just going to encourage the listeners to actually get out and read Storyland. But one that particularly fascinated me was the story of Lola, Mary, Abe and Jewel. And so they're running a dairy farm at the turn of the century, so 1900, and they have to face down suspicion and prejudice within their community. Their community itself, it's something of a melting pot, and the issues, if not their direct circumstances, and I'm thinking of racism, xenophobia, male privilege and male violence, to me, they mirrored our own troubled world. Is this just something of an indictment on how far we've actually failed to come in some 117 odd years?
Well, yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, that you can look at something that historical and go, that's me now. I had that experience recently, actually. I watched a play called The Secret River that was in a quarry, and I thought, this is a story about now, even though it's set in the early colonial days. I guess, you know, it is. We keep not really solving our problems as a kind of country, our kind of racism problems. And what is it that we need to do in the future, facing those issues and also facing kind of issues to do with violent changes in the weather? And what might help us kind of go into the future? There's a beautiful quote, actually, by Hannah Arendt, who kind of says stories are a great way for us to stories create meaning without committing the error of defining it. And so they're a great way for us to talk with other people about, you know, what's going right or wrong.
And we are talking about Storyland. It's a new novel from Catherine McKinnon, woven across generations in the Illawarra region. Catherine, look, I really appreciate you taking the time to unpack some of this and help readers discover this absolutely fascinating Australian tale. Thanks for joining me on Final Draft.
Thank you.
And you are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Final Draft. My name's Andrew Popel. We're going to take a track right now before we come back with my interview with Michael Sala about his new novel, The Restorer, taking us to Newcastle in 1989. But right now, this is from Meg Mack, and the track is Low Blows.
You're coming round too late. I've taken off my face, and you won't like it. I haven't seen anyone in days, but it's best this way. You see, I don't like it. Don't wanna be anyone again. See, I don't like it, baby.
And wildly inventive, Colson Whitehead's 2017 Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Underground Railroad, has been lauded by Barack Obama and Oprah Winfrey. Join Colson at Sydney Writers' Festival as he sits down with New York Times book review editor Pamela Paul to discuss his imaginative exploration of the foundational sins of America. May 27, City Recital Hall. Tickets on sale at swf.org.au. Sydney Writers' Festival, sponsors of 2SER 107.3.
Good morning. You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Final Draft, and my name is Andrew Popel, and I'm joined now via Skype from Newcastle by Michael Sala, and we're going to be talking about his latest book, The Restorer. Michael, welcome to Final Draft.
Hi, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. I'm excited. I mentioned off-air that The Restorer is so far one of my picks for 2017. I found it gripping. It's such an amazing story, well written, and I think it really has a lot to say to us. Now, of course, the Restorer, it takes us to Newcastle, and it's the beginning of 1989, and Marianne and Roy, their two children, Freya and Daniel, arrive at a rundown old terrace in the heart of the Steel City, and they're here to restore the house. Roy's bought it, and we learn that it's an attempt, at least on Roy's part, to rebuild their family. There's an unspoken damage. It's torn Marianne and Roy apart. Roy's seeking to mend those boundaries. The setup is fantastic. What also intrigued me is Newcastle is your hometown. That's where I'm speaking to you. It's undoubtedly changed in the intervening years. Perhaps some readers even might not immediately click to the historical significance of 1989. Building across the narrative, world events, but also Newcastle's own tragedies, create this really strangely charged atmosphere, vacillating between hope and despair. What was it for you, though? What was it like going back to this part in your history and the history of Newcastle?
Oh, look, it was really interesting for me to look back at it. I knew that I wanted to set the book at least partly in 1989, because it was such an important year in Newcastle's history. I knew that the earthquake had happened during that year. But then when I actually started getting together my notes and thinking about what had happened, I was surprised at how many other things had happened during that year as well. So it was really one of those years, I think, that was a real crossroads in time, I guess.
And the juxtaposition of this very personal, this family story and these world events. I mean, we've got really essentially the end of the Cold War, the old guard. We have the earthquake in Newcastle, huge events on a much larger scale, and then this very personal story. Did you find that personal story could elbow its own space? Did you feel it changed the story knowing that this was on the horizon?
Yeah, look, I often feel like with the way we kind of, you know, we live our lives, we're always taking note of these big things that happen in the world. You know, you watch the news and you see these big things unfolding. And our response to that is often kind of really decided by what's going on in our lives, because ultimately what's right in front of us is often the most important thing, unless we're directly affected by historical events. And so we often kind of, you know, we're making these stories about our own lives all the time, and then we see something happening in the larger world, and depending on our mood, our state of mind, that can really affect how we engage with that and how that affects us.
The largest thing happening in your family's world, though, at the beginning of the novel is Roy's project to renovate and restore an old terrace. They've arrived in Newcastle, moved into this sort of derelict terrace. There's a hole burnt in the floor. You know, the rooms are, it's been unoccupied for quite a while. This would look very familiar, I think, to a reality show obsessed culture in 2017. But it becomes a lifeline of hope for Roy, for his future with the family. And it got me wondering, got me thinking, if our national obsession with, you know, fixing, flipping, rescuing property might similarly mask a deeper concern for our relationships. Do you have any perspectives?
Yeah, definitely. And that was really kind of one of these things that really drove me to write about this home renovation, because when I was growing up, my parents, they did this all the time. They were constantly renovating houses. Unfortunately, they were constantly moving from location to location, so they didn't really make a huge profit out of doing it. They're always just covering their costs. And it feels to me like back then in the 80s, this obsession with renovation wasn't really there. That really sort of seemed to kick off has really kicked off in the last 15 or 16 years. It's become this increasing obsession, you know, this investment of identity and who we are in property and, you know, you go to parties and people are talking about the renovations and the price of real estate and their portfolios and things like this. And I do feel like in Australia we have this really a bit of an unhealthy obsession with houses, and there's something kind of surface about that. There's a certain superficial element to that that kind of I guess can distract us from what really matters in life.
I stopped going to parties when I realised nobody wanted to hear about new novels. They just wanted to hear about new granite bench tops.
Yes.
And
there's certainly sort of, some conversations do seem to go that way, and that's sort of that idea of getting ahead rather than kind of just having a rich life in the present sort of thing.
And I wonder then, does it mask something? Is changing something about the facade or the interior of our home, is it code, or are our people using that as a way of renovating their life by proxy?
Well, I think that there's something really gratifying about, you know, making a profit on something, but also about transforming this physical space, because it's so much more straightforward than transforming any other part of your life. Mm. Everything else is kind of complex and nuanced, but, you know, you just with renovating a house, it's kind of a straightforward project, no matter how complicated it gets.
Angry renovators, please tweet at FinalDraft2SER. Leave Michael alone. Your book is actually a really fantastic evocation of that. But within it, we have so many diverse visions of masculinity, particularly Roy and Daniel, his son Daniel, could not be more different as father and son. We have Daniel's sort of wonder as he sort of moves through the world almost in a dream, infuriating Roy, who seems constantly tensed for the next slight. Overwhelmingly, though, I found in these masculine figures, there seemed to be this kind of barely checked physicality or almost violence. And I wondered if you thought this was perhaps something inherent to the masculinity, or was it a crutch that they were leaning on?
Yeah, look, I mean, I guess it depends what you mean by masculinity in a way. Mm. But, I mean, growing up in Newcastle, I felt that physicality was a really important quality as a male. You know, pretty much physical violence happened on a really regular basis at my school. Several times a week there'd be major fights and people enjoyed it. They'd call out, there's a fight, and everyone would have to go running. And I just felt I felt that there was this really sort of oppressive construction of masculinity, and it kind of went all the way from the schoolyard to the sporting field.
As the novel moves on, we see this physicality. It bursts into violence. Male violence looms across the narrative, and we'd probably now talk about a culture of toxic masculinity. That's probably not a term that would have been used in 1989. And it was brought shockingly into people's consciousness with the sexual assault and the murder of Lily on Stockton Beach in 1989. We have sort of that event is paralleled in the novel, and it really starts to enclose the spaces around us. Do you see any change? Reflecting back, like writing a book like The Restorer, do you see it as a part of history, a historical narrative, or is there some commentary on what we're going through now?
Look, I think it's a bit of both. I definitely think things have moved in a really positive direction. But, you know, at the same time, you know, 1989 isn't that long ago. And I was a 14-year-old boy in the same year and school as Lily. So I kind of saw the context of what happened there, and my experience of it is that toxic masculinity creates a kind of environment, and it kind of creates a mood and atmosphere that people just have to live with. And in a way, the expressions of violence, when something happens, that's part of it, but part of it is just the potential for it. Mm. Newcastle has come a long way. I mean, as a foreigner, because I was an immigrant, you know, growing up here, I was very much an outsider. But I feel like there is a much more sort of inclusive quality, both to gender and culture these days than there used to be. I think the identity of the city is really kind of blossoming and diversifying. But, you know, you still have those elements of male violence. You know, the idea of, you know, if I go for a run at night, it's not uncommon to be yelled at from a passing car by a bunch of guys driving along. And it's also not uncommon to, you know, if you're female and you're going for a jog, then it's 10 times as bad.
I am speaking with Michael Sala. He's joining me on Final Draft. Michael, thank you so much for coming on and discussing. As I've said, it's one of my picks so far for 2017, your new novel, The Restorer.
Budget Day is one of the most important sitting days of the year for our Parliament.
2SER will be live on the ground in Canberra, May 9 and 10, with our team of reporters and experts ready to bring you in-depth analysis and commentary on the Coalition's plans for the nation over the next 4 years.
Who will be the winners? Who will miss out? And how about that deficit?
Tune in May 9th and 10th to get 2SER's independent coverage of the budget.
Everything you need to know right here on 2SER 107.3.
You're on 2SER 107.3. You tuned into Final Draft. It's a half hour every week of books, writing and literary culture. I want to say huge thanks this week to Catherine McKinnon. We talked about her new novel, Storyland. Michael Sala, he joined me from Newcastle to discuss The Restorer. Two fantastic books. Do you know what, interestingly? Both those writers are going to be involved with the Sydney Writers' Festival. Couple of weekends' time. We are getting really ready for this. I'm going to be speaking to so many authors, bringing you those conversations on Final Draft and across 2SER's programming. So I'd really encourage you to stay tuned, get ready, get psyched up. It doesn't matter where you are. If you're listening online from across New South Wales, across Australia, the Sydney Writers Festival is so huge this year. The live and local means that you're going to be able to tune in from wherever you are. Look, don't go anywhere. The Vulture's Nest is coming up. Those guys have got their unique take on the week's events, current affairs, media, popular culture. And I've got to leave you. I have to say goodbye. I'm going to go do some reading. But I've got a track for you. I'm going to say goodbye with a track, go do some reading, back next week with more books. And this is from the Courtneys. This is called Silver Velvet. My name is Andrew Popel. I'll see you next week for more Final Draft.